If you'll turn with me to the book of Hosea, chapter 4, and I'm going to read it to you, I want to ask you, does this have a kind of contemporary feel to it? See how it sounds. I'm wanting to use Hosea 4 and passages in chapter 6 to frame our thinking this afternoon. As we've travelled today, what we sought to do in our first time together is to take a look at what culture was and to show that culture is shared symbols of meaning. There are places where it surfaces. There are forces that shape it. It is the heart trying to make sense of its existence. It has those collective hearts just presume that's how the world is. Then you have a culture. In America, it's a fascination to see this country that should have been a vast constellation of Belfasts come together into a cohesive force. They had some statesmen who were geniuses. They got rid of the divisive edge of their Puritan theology, picked up the major themes of the Old Testament, liberty and justice, and told them that's what they're about. And when the Americans tell their story, they tell not the story as it is, but what's called a myth, the story of their belief systems. And you will not understand America unless you understand that. Let me illustrate. If I was to get you to name for me the boat that brought the first Americans across, first white Americans across, what's the name of the boat? Just see. Mayflower. I thought you'd say the Mayflower. But 13 years before the Mayflower, the British arrived in Virginia and were growing tobacco to make King George wealthy. But the Americans won't tell you that. They had as many convicts as we did. And the founding fathers, the ones they call the founding fathers, the pilgrims, come much later. They rather that story because they know, and we have the literature, we know what was in their minds. As far as they were concerned, they were not crossing the Atlantic, they were crossing the Red Sea to open up, in their language, the final chapter of God's salvation history. A place where Christ, not man, would be king. And so they told their story from that point of view and that framework. And so in America, because the founding fathers wanted freedom for religion, they then thought that everybody had a right to worship in whatever way they wanted to, etc. But so long as they did worship, they have this great contradiction of this great people who are very religious in many ways, and yet the 157 varieties of religion that's there. But Thomas Jefferson, the mate, got hold of that theology, got rid of what could cause difficulties for those in Maryland, which where the Catholics were celebrating, and picked up the major themes of the Old Testament and said, this is who we are. And so in the darkest days of American history, this leaps to life. When they were jumping out of buildings in Wall Street at the collapse of the economy during the Depression, leaping into the mind of an American cartoonist, Wayne and Schuster, comes Superman, able to leap buildings in a single bound. But he's a Judeo-Christian mythical figure, coming from Krypton. Churches have crypts, it's a kind of a secret place. And dual nature, he's a messianic figure. Moses, sent off in the bulrushes. And when they made, I happened to be in Hollywood, when they released the movie Superman. And they had to sign the document that thick, Donna, the producer, that they would not destroy the myth. You were not allowed to laugh at Superman. You were to laugh with him. They would actually put bits into the movie and say you would laugh. So the helicopter was about to fall on the head of Lois Lane, and here's Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter, and he's got to get his blue and red joggers on, hasn't he? He doesn't have much time. And the only phone booth has the bottom missing, and he looks back at the camera and you share his dilemma and you laugh, and it was written into release dress as part of the thing. But no, we must preserve the myth. We have to. It's a part of our culture, they said. It's a part of the heart of who we are. So when he lands on her flat roof house in Metropolis and says, who are you? She says, Lois Lane to Superman. He says, I'm Superman. I'm for truth, justice, and the American way. You were not meant to laugh there, but Ozzy thought it was the funniest part of the movie. And so we're a different bunch by any measurement. For the Americans, within their culture and myth, they believe that God will come down and speak through the man of God, and they'll have these big buildings like the old synagogues, the gathering place, the meeting house, Aussies expect to meet God out in the bush around a campfire with a bunch of mates. Freedom in America is a different creature to freedom in Australia. Freedom in America is freedom to believe. Freedom in Australia is freedom from interference. They say in this country, nobody wins an election, the last lot just lose. We'll see how it goes tonight. That's if we think the next lot are better than the last lot, even though we're fed up with the previous lot. Personal sovereignty is a key issue to us. Having come from a convict colony, they knew what it was like to fall into the hands of the police establishment. Didn't like it at all. They weren't. We have the records of the early native-born Australians were some of the most moral people in the colony, not of the purity of their hearts. They didn't want to lose their freedom. And freedom matters. Not telling me what to do, mate, is also part of how it's known and experienced in this country and culture. More inclined to know what they don't want than what they do want. More sensitive to the impinging of pain. Aussie blokes are hypersensitive to the burden and stress of responsibility. That's why in some ways we make very good missionaries with developing countries. The Americans have clear belief systems, they come with them, and there are so, in America even the Messiah are following one. The Brits are conscious of authority in a different kind of way. We don't want to be the boss. If you want to destroy a carpenter, you make him the foreman. But we do want to be one of the mates who lends a hand. So and with the emergence through the gold rush period, we haven't had a chance to touch on that, and the stump meetings, they were very practical to start with. Hey, geez, mate, why did you dig your dunny so close to the creek? Can't have a decent cup of tea anymore. Oh, I'm sorry, mate. That was about the level of the conversation. But later on, the Chartists and some of the Americans from the Californian Gold Rush come, and then they articulate the frustrations that were here, but they were pushed under. And on the 11th of November, a date I think we should call our Heritage Day, they gather in Bakery Hill, 10,000 diggers, because a digger mate, had been killed, and that was it. You don't do that. They go and burn the hotel down. That's how frustrated they were. And then it was on, and we call it the Eureka Stockade. But by any measure, it's different. It's interesting to take a look at the themes, though. I don't believe Aussies have a clear sense of right and wrong. They have a sense of justice and mercy, hypersensitive to injustice, but not highly refined. They're a bunch of pragmatists. It either works, mate, or it doesn't. No amount of talk is going to change it. Functional. Another measure of it is, I went to church once, got nothing out of it. Not whether it's right in itself, it's its function. They want math, English, science, whatever, to get their kids a job, but if they're going to take what they call religion seriously, it has to illuminate the dilemmas of their personal existence and show them the nature where goodness is. But it's all a bit doubtful that they ache for it. But it's functional. He's a good bloke. He'll do anything for you. Is about as near as they get. But morality is not a superficial question. I happen to believe we Aussies, and Aussie Christians particularly, are in a bit of a fog. We too are more inclined to know what's we want to limit behaviour. When it comes to the media, we can predict the things they'll have us talking about. Euthanasia, abortion, homosexuality. And it's all to do with limiting behaviour rather than illuminating the path forward to wholeness and full humanity. This is not superficial, it seems to me, as we get ready for the 21st century. As we gather for get ready for the 21st century, it seems to me the great threat of our time is dehumanisation. Don't have the time. I would really love to have had the time to take a look at biblical anthropology. What does the Bible say is the nature of our personal existence? In the past, let's be frank, we from the assemblies and us evangelicals have been very inclined to say, man is a sinner, beginning, end of the story. But it's told us nothing about our personal existence. The Bible goes much further. It says Christ is the light which lights every man that comes into the world. See, how do you fit about that? Don't get me wrong, there is a mad side. The heart of man is deceitful and desperately wicked. Who can know? Only a fool knows their own heart and is convinced of it. There is a zoo of motivations down there. But if you can hear it, there is another part. That God's Spirit comes when the Spirit is working. And even my own daughter's tiny ear as a baby can be used of God to touch you. A beautiful rose, a sunset, will remind you of the morn. And Aussies expect to see God out there in the bush, in their world, in their native habitat. It is new to us, and we're still getting used to what that means. If you want to see where the Spirit is rising in the collective culture, and this is the challenge, to hear this not in a New Agey kind of way, but find our bearings again and move with confidence was what we're shooting for. Listen to where they laugh, where they cry, and where they go wow. The Spirit is trying to break through the soul at those places. Spent time with a Canadian who was passing through here, visited us, was fascinated by our marches. He was part of the global march over there. And he said, oh, well, we don't do anything, you know, we don't trust the media, we know they'll just distort it anyway, so we just expect to keep them away. We're just marching for an audience of one, and that's Jesus. Well, that sounded very pious. And they said, we don't trust them either, that's why we write press releases and write very clearly the best places for them to put their cameras to get their shots. We manage it thoroughly, welcome them, and do a thorough job on relations there. So our message and our rhetoric comes through the voice of the presenter, because we know how it is. And yet we're marching for an audience of one too, but we love the idea that we can be marching for our master, but in the living rooms of the massive people in Australia. And he started thinking, and I said, look, we've been working very hard to manifest God in the culture so our people can see it in the way they see and be drawn to it. He said, I don't know how that would work in Canada. And I said, well, check it out. Are there any places where Canadians go, wow? Went quiet. He said, I think, yes, the Northern Lights. Whenever they're filling the sky, we bring our children out, whether we're French Canadians or if we're Inuits or Eskimos or First Nations people, we call them Indians. And that connect, yes, the heavens declare the glory of God. I said, go back and do some work. Something rises in those moments, and there's a collective experience there. And I said, hey, I happen to believe when we surround the throne finally, there'll be those singing from every tongue and every tribe. And I said, I only just in recent years come to the thoroughgoing conclusion, hey, there's going to be an Aussie accent in that choir. And my people are going to be there. And hey, I think it's right for there to be a Canadian accent, and a French Canadian accent, and an Eskimo accent, and an Indian accent. And our task is to know our spirits thoroughly, but to cock our ears so we can hear in harmony with those of other cultures, other tongues, other accents. And as we become constant in our part in the choir, then the harmony will build and the divisions will disappear. But I said, we need a sound morality, a sound sense of the nature of goodness, to hold back the perfectly normal things that create division, fears and envies, boundary protections and all the rest of it. As we get ready for the 21st century, where are we going to find these bearings and how important are they? I'm going to assert to you, morality is not a side issue, it's the central issue. When the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and throws himself down in the dust, coughing up mud pies, makes a real big thing of it, and says, good teacher, I've got the big Dorothy Dix question. Tell me how I can have the full life, the eternal life. And then Jesus says, you call me good, why are you calling me good? Sounded like he was nitpicking. You could almost imagine the disciple saying, oh Lord, be careful. I mean, he's a rich young ruler. We get 25 points for a convert from that kind of stream. And he doesn't. He proceeds beyond that. The issue is goodness. That's why he's still searching. He virtually, as the old rabbi would have done, sat him down on the mat, patted him on the head, and then went over the Ten Commandments. And it's interesting how generous Jesus was. He leaves out three of the commandments. You take a look at it. The ones he misses out are the first one and the last one. What's the first commandment? Yes, no other gods before me. And he had been fought because his money had become a god. And what's the last commandment? Thou shalt not covet. He was, and the other one, the Sabbath day one, just Mark the Seventh-day Adventist, probably. Whatever that was, Jesus said, oh, it's about morality. It's about the nature of goodness. And the young man goes away sorrowful. Because how many of us could say we've never lied, that we've honoured our parents? He said he could. And in that measure, it was okay. But still the gap, the vacuum was there. Why? Because God himself was missing. The wonderful thing about our salvation, we know how it works. He was made to be sin for us who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God. And this is the exciting news. As you stand there today, our Christianity is not an abstraction. Where you are sitting is holy ground. The mystery that's been hid from civilizations in the past is now disclosed to you, Paul says, 1 Colossians 26 and 27. Christ is in you and among you, the hope of what is the glory of God? Moses says, show me your glory, Exodus 33:18. And in chapter 34, we see what's manifest. His essential nature, his justice, his mercy, and his compassion. Toynbee built a whole theology and philosophy around it. He quote, the great student of civilization, he said, and I quote, nations rise or fall on their relationship to the glory of God. He went back and looked how often that little phrase there you find in Exodus 34 gets repeated over and over and over in times of crisis amongst the people. Jonah's in the whale, and you'll find that phrase comes up. Nehemiah's opening up the walls and having their great Jesus march around the walls, and he reminds them of what it is. And what they're being reminded of is the nature of God. Anything less than that is sin. But we have the life of God within us. God's longing, though, is to manifest it through us into time and space. Morality is not an abstraction. It is nothing more or less than the life of God itself expressing itself. The values, the commandments in the New Testament, be slow to speak and quick to listen, etc., etc., are designed to hold back the destructive side that Paul called the flesh, so the dream could come fully alive. Now, as we come to the 21st century, the great question we have is, what will goodness look like there? The old consensus has disappeared. Those professions suffering most stress nowadays are those who have to cope with the question, listen to this, what is a person, when does a person begin, when does a person end? And what ought a person do? And what can a person do? Who'd want to be a headmaster nowadays, or a policeman? Or a teacher even. They're at the front edge of the collapse of the consensus as to what morality is. When does a person begin? When do they end? Let me tell you, and let the word get out, if I'm dead, turn off the support systems if it's time for me to go. Don't hold me back here. I'm not fearing what I'm going through. I'd have done my time. I've been happy to hear the words, well done. Don't hold me back. Don't give me a late mark. I want to get out and get home. But it is pivotal. I think the great battle as we move to it, and the church has to understand this. It is not about arguing with others about the right idea. The great threat of our time, in my view, is dehumanization. What does it mean to be human? To be human means to reflect the nature of God. That is the great distinguishing feature of our humanity. What is the chief end of man in the old catechism? To glorify God and enjoy him forever. We have this treasure in earthen vessels that the glory may be of God and not of us. The suffering of this time is not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us and to us and through us. Whether this registers on your sense of self, on your sense of identity, is not the question. If you've ever been translated out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of his dear Son, at the core of who you are, you will never be a happy person unless this longing to love God and express his nature in your time, unless that's fully unless the division in your psyche, the divided self is dealt with, so you are wholehearted in these regards, you will not be happy. You will not be happy. And the paradox is to yield to God is to have our humanity given back to us. I find it interesting. Psalm 106, it said, and they forsook the glory of God, virtually, and created a God after their own image. Can you remember what the image was they made? Is it a golden calf? If it was after their image, they must have been funny looking people at that point of time. But it's fascinating, the imagery. As they projected out the animal side of who they were, whatever they covered with, whether it was gold or sophistication or education, it was still basically the animal. The reason our economy's been in strife, because the animal drivers of fear and greed are the dominant forces that are operating there, rather than justice, mercy and compassion. And what Toynbee said, a nation state moves around long until it hits a crisis. When it hits the crisis simply asks a question about the essential morality of the people. If self-absorption is the dominant force operant, when it hits the crisis, it'll start fragmenting. And this group, instead of owning their responsibility, will blame this group. And this group will blame that group. Does it sound familiar? And the further they go down those paths, attitudes will harden. They'll feel quite justified in doing very sick things like, dare I say, forging things to win elections and all that sort of stuff, whoever did it. Morality will go up as self-preservation, self-absorption. That's why we haven't respected them. They are not exhibiting the glory of God. But come back to what's at the core of the Australian psyche. A sensitivity. The Simpson and his donkey? Is that ugly or wrong? A love for the Salvation Army? Are these hypersensitive to justice? It doesn't mean to say they are born again. But some of their instincts and antenna are pointed in the right direction. And if there's justice, mercy and compassion, that is the climate in which humanity can grow. If you know there's justice, and truth. Mercy most literally means getting inside the skin of another. And this is where conflict resolution really happens in the industrial world and family. As this side gets inside the skin of this side, as this side gets inside of the skin of this, instead of fighting for their own supposed justice, they see the justice of the other person's position. As the businessman gets inside the skin of the working man, and the working man inside the skin of the businessman. It says the wife gets inside the skin of the husband, and vice versa, as they both get inside the skin of their children, not just trying to control them. But weeping with those who weep and rejoicing with those who rejoice, we then have the foundations, motivated by the glory of God, for the recreation of community that gives opportunity and safety for the delicate part in us to tell the truth, because we know we'll be received, to show our love, and to live with some of the risks of living life creatively. So here we are. We're so close to the 21st century. Will we just grind on like a locomotive, shaped by the mindsets of the past? Or will this be a place where the cry of the human spirit that feels like an orphan can look around somewhere where there are the echoes of home, the beckoning of completeness, the great shalom. I happen to believe when God created man, he created him into a network of relationships, a relationship with himself. We can call that the theological dimension to his existence, a relationship with himself. Derived from that relationship, we could call that the psychological dimension to his existence. A relationship with the other, in the initial case, the woman. The sociological dimension to his existence. Together, they had a relationship with the world around them, the ecological or environmental or technological dimension to their existence. But with the coming of sin, all the relationships are severed. And the great, great task of redemption is to repair all the connections, starting first with the relationship with God. Each one of us will have a different focus and bias depending on our gifting. Some of us are called to be God's greenies. Praise God for that.
Some of us are called to be entrepreneurs who see difficulties and solve them in a technological realm. Some of us are called to be hypersensitive to the social fabric and construct happy communities and families and to be those who are healing in that area. The word shalom most basically means a reintegration under God's rule. That's what peace is. Not the absence of conflict, but things finding their way back into the rule of God. And the Bible says, blessed are the peacemakers. It's in this role we show most clearly our likeness, our family likeness. They will be called the children of God. Where are we, brothers and sisters? As people look around, as we encounter them, what will they see? Come with me to Hosea, and I want to show you some contrasts. Chapter 4 and then chapter 6. Verse 1, chapter 4. Hear the word of the Lord, you Israelites, because the Lord has a charge to bring against you who live in the land. Listen to the language. There is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. There is only cursing, lying and murder, stealing and adultery. They break all bounds and bloodshed follows bloodshed. Because of this, the land mourns, and all who live in it waste away. The beasts of the field, and the birds of the air, and even the fish of the sea are dying. Do a jump to verse 6. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. Does it feel kind of contemporary? The charge is what? There's no faithfulness. No love, no acknowledgement of God. I believe both our media and our political institutions don't know how to deal with the transcendent, the truly spiritual, the nature of God. So it deals with what it can deal with and manage with budgets. There is only cursing, lying, murder, stealing, adultery. And listen to the language, they break all bounds. And bloodshed follows bloodshed. That's where we hear the cry of death. And because of this, the land mourns. All those who live in it waste away. The beasts of the field. And this is even the fish of the sea are dying. And what we're discovering as we come to the end of the 90s, that morality is not a matter of personal perception and choice. The life we live has implications. We can choose how we live, but we can't choose the consequences. If I commit adultery, there is a delicate membrane in my relationship with me and my wife, and something happens there that violates. I may try and sit on it, but a part of me knows I can fool some of the people some of the time, but my own spirit knows, and the withheldness in here makes its own statement in time, and my capacity for intimacy gets minimized. You name any of the commandments and we'll show you they have implications. Yes, as we move into the 21st century, the New Age people can say what they like, but there are some of the old boundaries that were red lights, not to be restrictive, but to show which way was forward. It's time to hear it again and to trust God. The danger is we find ourselves swept along by the new mindset and wonder. And the fantasies of all kinds rise. And the lines get blurred. They break all bounds. Morality is not just to do with what we do with our body, as important as that is. It's to do with the choices we take that affect the quality of life within us and around us. We've been living it for long enough. We've tried on the ideologies. We've looked at Marxism and see what death it produced. Hey, when Jesus said, I am the life, it wasn't an abstraction. It was to bring into focus that deep longing, the currency cube, the orphan inside. To say, I've come that you might have life and have it to the full. I can lead you back to the place of fulfillment. The eighth is out there. As never before,
the deepest longings within their hearts are on our side. But where will be the places they'll see the connection between their longings and an opportunity? You don't have people lining up outside a bakery if there's not the fragrance of hot bread coming through the front door. Let's be frank, for too often our Christianity has made us socially dysfunctional. You become a Christian, and the longer you're amongst your Christian peers, the more out of touch you come become with those. You learn this wonderful set of doctrinal abstractions, and you turn them on, and you send a smoke screen out there. No. It's time to come back and finish the work in here. To present our body the living sacrifice, wholly acceptable unto God, which is only our reasonable service. And then to continue the process of the renewing of the mind. So we see the 21st century not as a threat, but as the reason we were made. We see the pressures and pains and stresses of our current existence not as a curse from the devil that evokes unbelief and makes us think darkness is with it, but as the pain coming into the gum of a little baby that's the noise of a life that's coming. The pregnancy that's saying, listen, live with it, trust me in it. Go beyond the big give up line. Remember who I am, and whatever it costs, be crazy enough to live as though it's true. Go out there and look for the orphans. All the time facing the orphan in yourself. But remember where the boundaries are. Rediscover the old boundaries, and you'll find they never were old, they are always contemporary. They are the boundaries between life and death. We don't have to make them relevant. We only become relevant and fulfilled when we take them seriously. We have to rediscover their meaning, though, so we can articulate them in the heart language of those we go to. What is this knowledge that people are destroyed from lack of? In Job 32:8 it says, it's the breath of God in man that gives him understanding. The Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and he becomes a living being. We've already told you this morning, today, I would love to have talked to you about the coming of the Holy Spirit in John's Gospel. He breathes on. This is not God breathing, this is the God who's become flesh and has been through our hell, and who now lives on in the power of an indestructible life. And the life he now breathes into us is the life that's been through all of that. This is the righteousness of God in us. We have no excuses. It is only our fear and our unbelief that prevent this life from coming through. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. I often thought that was a bit convoluted, that argument. And I came across a character called Eric Fromm, a Marxist sociologist, dare I say, who talked about faith. It was his Jewish background, I think, that understood it. And I went back and he explained it. I still don't know how he got it. There must be some spark of spirituality. He says, faith is not uncertain. Faith knows. It sees the pregnancy, the possibility of tomorrow and today. It sees in the apple seed, the apple tree. It sees what might be. It's not a conviction, an absolute that will come to birth. But it has a certain set of eyes that can see what might be. As you look off to the 21st century, what can you see? Is there hope there? Is it darkness or a new day dawning? What kind of knowledge do you have? Is it just powerlessness that calls it bad?
Does the power of the resurrection mean nothing? In the darkest of all moments of human history, hope was born. God is able to take the darkest moment. Right at most haunting, John 13:30. Judas goes out to betray him, and Jesus says, "Now is the Son of Man glorified." In the darkest moment is the greatest opportunity for God's nature to be manifest in time and space. What will the church look? What will your congregation look like? What I know is every alive congregation will tell its people they have a job to do. However old or young, they have a precious privilege to write their part in the unfolding story of God's redemptive history. They have a chance to harmonize with the will of God. They have a chance to let eternity into time as their will matches His will, and collectively with their brothers and sisters. They will know, as it says in the book of Ecclesiastes, they won't always know what tomorrow looks like, and it will be a mystery. But they know God is in tomorrow. And as they walk with Him today, tomorrow is theirs, not darkness. God has set everything in its own time. Everything is beautiful in its time. Each moment is an opportunity. Let the old machinery defend its territory, avoid conflict, or let the glory of God manifest itself. In which case, every moment, even the giving of a glass of cold water in His name, takes on eternal dimensions. Nothing is trivial. It says also in the book of Ecclesiastes, around about chapter 3, verse 15, whatever the Lord does lasts forever. The congregations of the future will position their people clearly in their moment of history. Give them the kind of teaching that lifts up their eyes to know what hope is. Hope is the sense, as Colossians tells us, that it's finished, resolved in heaven for us. We're on the winning side. We've looked at the last chapter and we won. However it might look now, that hope means the releasing of faith. Faith can see and sense that because God's in tomorrow, it will reflect His nature, however it feels now, and releases love. It will mean whatever it costs that we will stand with those aspects of God's own nature in the moment, justice, mercy and compassion. That we will have iron in our souls. Courage will not be a difficulty, because we know the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and He set us into the world to reclaim what He has redeemed. This is ours. It be darkness go. This is our moment. The sun has come. Let's quickly jump to second passage in Hosea. Hosea 6. What about the second coming, some may say? Yes, well, I don't know how to break the news to you, but I can't see any reason why, and I actually expect Jesus to come in 1996. I expect Him to come this year. If He doesn't come this year, I'll expect Him to come next year. If He doesn't come that year, I'll expect Him to come the following year. And I'll live as though He's coming today, but I'll plan as He told me to, and I'll work as though He's not coming in my lifetime. So when it is time, and I'm pleasantly surprised, He'll say, "Well done. You were found working when I came." And this is the promise. Chapter 6, verse 1. "Come, let us return to the Lord. He has torn us, but He will heal us. He has injured us, but He will bind up our wounds. After 2 days, He will revive us. On the third day, He will restore us, that we may live in His presence. Let us acknowledge the Lord. Let us press on to know Him. As surely as the sun rises, He will appear. He will come with us, come to us like the winter rains, like the spring rains that water the earth." Here in Sydney, it's strange living in Tassie. The weather's all the wrong way around. But here, I know when the westerlies come, you can see the grass dry up before your eyes and all the roads go back to tar. And you know you've just got to survive. It's what we call black feather weather. Let's get to the swimming pool and have a cold drink. We know when the southerly buster comes, and that's why we blame the Tasmanians and the Melbournes for it. It'll come, and this cold will come out of nowhere, and down it will come. But when it hits the ground after the westerly, you can almost hear the ground sigh. There's a fragrance in the air after it. Before that, it was dusty, and the throat was dry, but now there's a freshness in the air, the fragrance of life. I believe for many of us, we've been on a bit of a drought to our wilderness. I think God is saying, hey, we are closer to the promised land than we've ever been. Look around for the two or three who will be your friends. Don't be content with just your congregation. Those who focus on the congregation will betray the congregation. Look to the region and say, this is ours, Lord. Give us grace to see our people in terms of how they fit in to reclaiming this as yours. Grant us grace to open our hearts and welcome all of God's people to see what your body may look like in this region. Grant us the heart of the networker, like Paul, who wove the web around the Mediterranean and brought Christianity to the Western world, which we celebrate today. To be able to see the gift that's there, to see the needs that are there, and bring the gift and need together so it's released into its role and its destiny, knowing that ultimately it will reflect the glory of God. It's amazing what Paul would put up there so long as faith and love were there, the sense of the spiritual. So everybody in the congregation isn't seen as some kind of threat or some kind of opportunity. You see them not in terms of what they are, but in terms of what they might be. As Jesus saw Peter, Simon, and called him stone, rock foundation, it wasn't on the basis of what he was, but what he was going to be. We all long for somebody to see us in terms of what God's going to make us. Work hard to deal with your own neuroses, to project your own insecurities onto your children, your wife, your congregation, and needs control and to project its frustrations. You'll betray your trust. Lovest thou me more than these, Jesus said to Peter as he showed him his old identity, the fish, the nets, the symbols of all that told him he was potent and significant. If you do, then feed my lambs. It's time to prepare congregations for the 21st century, but we need to prepare our own hearts. It's a revival, an awakening that's coming. But what lies at the deep core of the heart has a chance to break through to the mind and know itself, and then express itself in time and space in company with its brothers and sisters. And the only thing that will stop that happening is our own unbelief and lack of values that holds back the destructive impulses of our own history and sickness and sin. We were made for such a time as this. In conclusion, at the end of Christ's life, this is an apocryphal story, but I find it with some use. He ascended up to heaven and the angels applauded as he arrived back. Great celebration broke out as they threw their halos into the air and held each other up and cheered and clapped. They said, Lord, it was very scary to watch toward the end. That lot you picked, oh my goodness, where did we get them from? But we've made it. That we're ready to go, Lord. The triumph. Let's blow the trumpets, cast back the darkness, and tell darkness the chains are broken. You have no power. Fire the gun, Lord. We're off to tell the world. Hold on, he says. No, we're not going to do that. What do you mean? The victory's been won. We've been waiting for this moment. Oh, we're waiting for the finishing line. It was exhausting. Oh, Lord. Let's go. It's not your job.
But we're angel messengers. That's what our name means.
It is not your job.
Lord, who's going to tell the world? Who's going to tell them the darkness is defeated?
They are. Oh, Lord, you picked up a Jewish sense of humor since you've been away.
Oh,
they look down from the portals of heaven and see these little ant-like figures going off, still trying to compute the ascension.
What if they fail?
We have no other plan. We have no other plan. The saints in the past had their turn. Hebrews 12:1 was surrounded by that cloud of witnesses as they looked down. And these are our games. Over the loudspeakers it comes, 1996, up to the year 2000 and beyond. This is our event. They wait, wanting to cheer, saying, take your time, take your place at the blocks, but run the race with patience, looking off to Jesus, the author and the finisher, laying aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset you. Know it and name it. Don't avoid it. Know it. Face the virus and pull it out. So you too may hear the words. Well done. I finished the race. Well done. Thou good and faithful servant.